What's up, folks? This is Evan, and I'm joined as always by Sasha. How you doing, Sasha?
Hello, everybody. I'm doing good. Wrestling season is finally over, and I forgot how long it was. It's a grind.
It's definitely long. And listeners, there might be some fun audio stuff going on with this episode for a couple reasons. A, I am in a different location. I've been relegated to our dining room to record today. I'm a little sick, so I might sound a bit nasally. And I'm hearing some weird stuff coming through my audio that I hope is not being replicated anywhere. So we'll see how that goes. Hopefully, it's not too big of a deal. I wanted to check in real quick. Last time we recorded an episode is right towards the beginning of the wrestling season. Is there anything you want to particularly talk about that has happened since then in the wrestling season? We're coming right up on conference championships here.
Yeah, I guess it's been a while, huh? I'm sure our haters, they were probably licking their chops. They thought it was going to be the downfall of the Archaic Wrestling Podcast. They were saying it's going to be another podcast that two guys do five episodes of and then never do again. Well, to those people, I'd like to say, guess what, buddy? It's going to be a podcast of two guys that do 30 episodes and never do again, okay? So you better watch out. We're still pumping these things out. It's still an undetermined amount of time that this keeps going on.
I've told you before, I think we got like close to 1,000 episodes in us. I think that's where it'll be. That's where it'll be. But yeah, you're right. We're back. It has been a little while. I don't know if there's too much to report on the college season right now. I think everyone knows what's up. All we can really say is 125 is going to be wild. We're really curious to see where that goes. A lot of seeding is going to come into play with that. But yeah, it's looking to be another fun year where Penn State wins and it's a battle for second place again.
Could you imagine if Shane Van Ness did not get injured? They could
Oh
have
yeah.
had conceivably in the within the realm of possibility, like what, seven or eight champs? With him, in a more likely sense, they would have been maybe favored for what, like six? 41, 49, 57, 65 is conceivable, 74, very possibly 84, 97, 285. If you take two of those out, you're looking at favored to win like five, possibly. It's insane. It's insanity. We got ourselves, it's like a Poway type situation here. It just gets crazier and crazier. Rich get
I mean,
richer.
that's, I mean, sure. I'm not going to get into Poway. I'm not going to talk about Poway today. I will, I, you know what? I will get into Poway. You know what? We talked, we talked earlier just about how you didn't have a full spectrum of my wrestling experience in high school.
Yes, I did
So
not.
I'll tell you
I
two
still don't.
stories.
Surprised somehow.
I'll tell you two stories. So my very first match ever, the high school I was at was the same league as Poway. So we wrestled Poway in a duel every year. My very first varsity match ever. I had started wrestling as a freshman in high school. I wrestled one JV tournament. And I went like 2-2 or two or something like that. Got my face ripped off. It was like big shock, right? But after getting a little experience, I beat the guy that was who was had the varsity spot in the wrestle off. And so I got to wrestle in the duel that week. And it was against Poway.
Oh
And
my God.
the wrestler's name was Pat Payne. He went on to wrestle he went on to wrestle for ASU, and he at the time was ranked the fourth best wrestler at that
My
weight class.
God.
The 140s, yeah,
Oh
in the nation, fourth best in the nation.
my God.
That match didn't last long. I think it was a 32-second match before I got pinned. But yeah, that was a fun experience for my very first varsity match, like my fourth or fifth match ever. So yeah, that was my experience, my first experience with Poway. Well, and the other story I was going to tell you about was in my junior year. I was wrestling up in the Clovis area, and my team's football team, because I played football as well, we were in the playoffs. So wrestling season was overlapping a bit with football season, and wrestling was my main sport at that time, even though I enjoyed football. And so the Zinkin Classic was going on at the same time. And it just, and so I was like, okay, normally you'd have to pick, hey, we are either going to, you know, I'm either going to go to this wrestling tournament or I'm going to, you know, stick with football and do my, the playoff game. But the playoff game was happening at the same school, Buchanan High School, as the Zinkin Classic was being held. So I went to the tournament, all day Friday. And then, I was like 2-1 at that during the tournament. So I was in consos, and the football game was starting. So I left my singlet on and I had all my football equipment with me and I ran over to the football stadium. And I had missed warmups. I had, you know, I had, you know, the pre-walkthrough stuff I had completely missed, but hey, I was warm enough. I put on all my football gear. And I went out and I played in the first half. I wasn't a starter at the time, so I didn't have to play too much. And I played the first half of the football game. And then at halftime, I ran back over to the gym and I was still in all my football gear. So I come running into the gym in football helmet, football pads. And I'm taking stuff off as I'm coming to the mat. Right. I'm running over there and like, it's like Superman taking off of his clothes and I have my singlet on underneath. And so I run out, I wrestle my next match, I lose close. So I'm out of the tournament, but it's like, all right. And then I run back over to the football field and I still got my singlet on. I throw in all my football gear, we go out, do the second half. And yeah, that was actually a really fun, story to tell, for college essays.
Yeah.
Cause I got to be like, oh, this is how dedicated I am. You know, it was a good one.
That is insane. I don't know how. I mean, it must have took a lot out of you coming to the mat and then, you know, having just played football.
The football game wasn't even the real problem. The real problem was sprinting over to the gym from the field, because they weren't close together necessarily. So I was all out of breath going each way.
Yeah. I mean, it's one thing to be a two sport athlete, but two sports in the same day is a bit much.
Ben Cooter could never.
What did your coaches have to say about it?
The football coaches, like, they weren't too concerned with it because I wasn't a starter. Yeah. And they were just like, hey, that was cool. You did that, you know? And my wrestling coaches, I don't remember them commenting on it. You know, I made it to all my matches.
So you're walking to the mat with a football helmet still on, taking it off as you get to the table to reveal yourself. And they're just sitting there like, this is normal. This is fine.
I mean, they knew I was going to be doing it. I think they just thought it was funny, you know, and I was brand new to the high school too. So this was like my first, like, you know, really tough tournament. So I think they were just more concerned with like learning what, you know, where my faults were and stuff and how I needed to improve. So it wasn't too big of a deal.
Their introduction to you as a wrestler was coming off the football field. What position did you play? What weight were you when this happened too?
Oh, so I played linebacker mostly. So a little bit of outside, a little bit of inside. I was kind of small, cause I only weighed one. I was wrestling, 160 my junior year. We had a guy at 45 that was better than me, a guy at 52 that was better than me. In the beginning of the year, they had me wrestling up at 170. In fact, up at 172, because I just hadn't wrestled off with anybody yet. And then they ended up getting the spot for 160. Which was nice because I only weighed like 155 and I never had to cut weight that year.
Yeah. So you were one of the weights that it actually makes sense for someone to be playing football and wrestling.
Yeah. I went down to 45 my senior year after that. And that was a little different experience, but a better experience overall. So let's talk about wrestling history. And before we get into our topic today, we did get a little bit of feedback on our episode on Mongolian wrestling, the bulk wrestling. I was just, you know, on Reddit and there were some, there was like a, someone posted about Mongolian wrestling and, you know, how It was like on an MMA forum or something like that. And there was a guy commenting under there who seemed to like really be into Mongolian wrestling and, you know, just seemed to be a fan of it. He wanted to share things about it with people. And I thought, hey, you know, I'm going to share our episode with this guy. I just kind of commented on it. And before, and like, so all of his responses to people before that had been kind of like, you know, paragraph length, you know, he's going into details, really excited about things. And then after I shared that with him, he started responding to me, and he responded to me a couple of times, but each response was like small sentences. Like his tone suddenly changed. His main things were he had gripes with us saying that our skepticism about the cave paintings, whether it actually depicted Mongolian wrestling. So that was one thing.
Just like, how dare you?
Yeah, these and then sticks. He also, there was the moment where we commented on the guy's name his name was Buri Boka, right? And we were a little skeptical that was like even a real guy necessarily, just because it sounded too on the nose, right? And his claim was like, no, that person was real and his descendants are still alive and all this stuff. And I just kind of responded to this stuff because I was like, oh, you know, because, you know, he did seem to be really into it. Maybe, I don't know, right? And I was like, oh, and I like went and rechecked stuff and tried to figure out if I could find more information about these specific things. And no new information that I could find. But I was like, you know, maybe he knows something. So I asked him and he never responded. I was like, do you have any sources on this? I want to learn more. Yeah, he never responded to any of that. So yeah, hey, you know what, maybe we were a little too skeptical about some stuff, and maybe there's some sources out there that are not
to
English,
be clear,
right?
Buri Boka was the guy who got his back broken and then instantly died, right? That was
correct
from the semi-mythological story.
Yeah, but his descendants are still around apparently.
Okay, well, I guess he had kids before the incident.
I don't know, man. We'll have to, maybe we'll learn more down the line. We'll see. But yeah, that was a little bit of feedback. No closure to this, I guess. The debate goes on amongst our academic peers. If anyone out there has anything, you know, DM us on Twitter or something, use our email address that we don't check. And just get in touch with us.
Yeah. So today we're going to be going over Cornish wrestling. So Cornish wrestling hails from Cornwall. Cornwall is an area in the UK. It is the like lowest southernmost tip of the UK, and they have their own style of wrestling there. That is, one, they're very proud of it. A lot of these sources we went through evinced a lot of praise for Cornish wrestling over the awful Devonshire wrestling. Certainly better than that awful Breton Gorin wrestling. And it is a style of wrestling that takes place between two guys on a field wearing jackets. So it's one of our classic jacketed wrestling styles that we've seen a decent amount of so far.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the some of those other local styles, because from what we understand, you know, there's a lot of Celtic history, obviously, in this area. They, like pretty much everyone else, have their own sort of tradition of wrestling that is localized to like indigenous cultures, right? And it is nice that we're finally getting over here to the Northern European side of things. The folks of the Caucasian persuasion have been relegated to the sidelines of this podcast for far too long. So we're glad that we can give some attention to some of my brethren. So a lot of these like different styles, and you mentioned like Devonshire and like the Breton styles, right? A lot of these are like very like incestuous styles, right? They're all kind of like mixed together. They're all kind of coming from these like Celtic origins. Like some of them have like slightly different rules. Like the Devonshire folks, it looks a lot like Cornwall wrestling, but then you're allowed to kick people in the shins, right?
Yeah, they got some shin kicking over there.
Yeah, yeah. So Cornwall, I think we're going to focus on just because it's it's a little bit more well known. You know, we might get to some of these other styles later on, but just kind of understand, listener, that this is a little bit of a broad range of styles that do exist within the British Isles. So this style definitely at least goes back hundreds of years. And I do want to point out really quickly, as we get into some of the information we'll be sharing, we relied heavily on a research paper for this entitled Persistence of Difference, A History of Cornish Wrestling by Michael Tripp. So big shout out. We'll have a link in the description to that paper. But it had a ton of information that, you know, was really interesting. We can't cover all of it. It was over 500 pages.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of really good information in there. Was pretty cool. So really relying on that source for this. So they suspect that this style goes back hundreds of years. The earliest written evidence for it is in the 1500s, where there's writing saying that Henry VIII actually spectated some Cornish wrestling. And this was a style that traditionally would be for like special occasions, right? Like there would be, you know, a funeral or a holiday, you know, or like a harvest thing or weddings, right? This is when like local communities would have their wrestling matches as kind of a way to come together, which shouldn't sound too different from a lot of other folk styles that we've covered before.
Yeah, it's very similar. Yeah, I mean, it reminds me a little bit of the Mongolian wrestling. I mean, all of them, it seemed like they were using this as a way to, things were boring back then.
Yeah.
So there was always looking for an occasion to be partying, to have some fun doing something.
Yeah. And something Tripp talks a lot about in this research paper is how back then there was a lot more opportunity for leisure. Right. And that didn't mean like people weren't working hard back then, but they were beholden to like the cycles of the earth. Right. And
yeah.
Morning and night and things like that, a lot more than we are now. And especially before like industrialization. Right. That the whole industrial revolution changed a lot of ways in how people work. And that's not to say that they weren't working hard and having to have side gigs because their main jobs wouldn't actually like pay for everything. They had to go hunting and all that stuff. Right. But there was more opportunity for doing things like this as a community, right? And getting out there and not having to, you know, necessarily work 40 hours a week, right? So they had more opportunity to do things like this. And like you said, there wasn't a lot else to do necessarily. So fun times was wrestling time, and we approve.
Yeah, and then something I found was that most of the days that they would have the competitions, it seemed to be Sundays. So like the church-going days is when they would do this. Most of the other days, apparently back then, or at least, you know, in Cornwall, Saturday was always a day you were working. You were always working on Saturday. Sunday was a church day, and that's when they would traditionally do most of their competitions. I mean, like we said back then, it was the whole schedule was very different. I mean, it wasn't like a consistent 52 weeks of the year working 5 days a week type thing.
Yeah. I also mentioned like, it, you know, earliest written evidence. What I meant to say specifically was it was the earliest written evidence of actual competition. There was earlier references to the Cornish wrestling in the sense that the Cornish were wrestling people. So there's a very strong cultural significance of wrestling within Cornwall. Throughout this, you know, the last, you know, thousands of years or so, right? Like there's general references to wrestling in the Celtic areas going all the way back to like the Roman times, right? Even possibly further back. But in the Roman times, they even had like a myth where the Romans were coming into the area, and there's a myth of a Celtic giant called Gog Magog. And we know this is definitely a myth because of the giants.
No, that's a real guy, Evan.
Yeah, right.
His descendants are still living.
and the whole idea was like, oh, the Roman general or whoever wrestled the giant. So there's definitely this idea of the Celts wrestling being a big part of it, right? There's also references as early as 1415, which is the Battle of Agincourt, you know, which is part of that, you know, famous Shakespearean Henry V monologue, right? The St. Crispin's Day thing, where the Cornish Banner, the Cornish fighters, the bannermen of Cornwall, actually had wrestlers on their banner. So there's like a lot of connection with wrestling and Cornwall. And I pulled a quote actually from the 1600s, and this is from Thomas Fuller, who was a cleric, and he had this to say: Cornish are masters of the art of wrestling, and to give a Cornish hug is proverbial. And they also suggest that if the Olympic Games were now fashioned, they would come away with victory. So there's, even at this time, before the modern Olympics had come back, they were like, oh, the Cornwall people would win at wrestling if the Olympics still existed.
Yeah, there's a lot of, clearly, like, in these sources, a lot of pride about Cornish wrestling, about, you know, the Cornish people themselves being wrestling people. Like you said, like with the myth of Gog Magog. So Geoffrey of Monmouth, who was, I don't know, born like 1139, something like that, sometime around there, who was like, I guess, I don't know if he wrote it, or if he was the originator of it, or if like his version was the just became the most popular version, but he was the one who popularized the myth of like King Arthur, like the Arthurian tales and Merlin. His work, the Historia Regum Britannia, was, you know, huge in that. So in that, there's a story of the founder of Cornwall, Corineus, wrestling the giant Gog Magog and like throwing him off a cliff. I went and I looked at the passage, and unfortunately there was nothing about any specific moves. I mean, basically he fireman's carries. He does the only real move he does, he challenges him to a wrestling match. He does a fireman's carry on Gog Magog and throws him off a cliff.
Not a bad way to go.
The earliest we can find about the actual rules seems to be closer to like 1550, at least what I can see. 1550 or like 1600s. But clearly wrestling was a huge part of their like identity and culture before that.
And Tripp makes a point in his article about the idea of like pre-modern sports, right? So wrestling definitely falls into this kind of idea of pre-modern sports. And modern sports are going to be things like, you know, football or things like tennis, right? Where we're starting to use like these tools. And there's this interesting differentiation between, and we'll talk, I'll talk about it in a little bit, about the idea of like at certain points of history, like especially like the 1700s, if you can imagine how people are starting to consider things like wrestling to be, oh, that's a low man sport, right? It's a it's a sport for the non-wealthy, right? They can't afford a ball, right? They can't afford these nets and courts and things like that. Therefore, you know, they can't afford a horse to go fox hunting, right?
Yeah,
that's more of a low person sport. And like it's true, like the Cornwall or Cornish wrestling like didn't get its first governing body until 1923. Like it took that long for a governing body to be established.
Which is crazy to think about, especially considering from looking at these sources, how much they were doing it, like how much people were spectating. And like with like the fervor they were spectating, there's like some funny stories, which are, you know, some of them, like we'll go over them later, maybe are apocryphal. But it does seem like it was extremely popular.
Yeah, really popular. But this also isn't like unique to wrestling. A lot of sports didn't go through real like gaining governing bodies or having like unified rules and things like that until like it's kind of a 20th century like thing as like sports become more commercialized and things like that, where the idea of having local rules is more of a no-no. Like you want to avoid that because, you know, you can't, it's harder to sell a football game between Yale and Harvard that way, right? You need guys need to unify your rules. So, you know, it doesn't surprise me too much to see that it took that long. You want to talk a little bit about like, what does this sport just look like when you're watching Cornish wrestling? What are you seeing?
Yeah. So you got two guys wearing like shorts, and they have this jacket on top. So it's got, you know, full sleeves. It's like a white canvas, and it's fairly loose. It's not not like a tight jacket or anything like that. And when they're wrestling, I would say like it looks a lot like judo. It's really similar to judo.
Yeah.
So the, you know, moves in it or the way you score is by getting what they call backs. Or was it what were the points called when you get?
No, you got it. Yeah.
It
like
was a hinge, right? Or it's a hitch.
Yeah. So back is essentially what we would call a pin or a fall. Right. Yeah. And the way you get a back is by having what they call pins. So in order to get a back, you need to have three pins down, three pins hitting the ground at the same time. And pins are your shoulders and your hips. So this is confusing. but so yeah, as you're wrestling someone, you're trying to get their hips and shoulders to the ground. If you can get the hips and shoulders to the ground, you win automatically, like you would with a pin, right? But they are calling that a back. If you were to only get one or two pins on the ground, then you would get a point for each pin that goes down, right? So the way you win a match is, you know, they have a generalized time limit. You either win within that time limit by getting a back, or you score a certain amount of pins, as in the points. And you can win by points as well. There's also what's called marks, which are essentially penalties. If you get three marks, that would result in like your opponent getting a point. You're not allowed to. And so like an example of a mark would be, supporting yourself on the ground with a hand, like, so you don't touch the ground, or a knee. I guess we should also mention, you know, it starts off with shaking of hands, right? Similar to us. And it's also two concentric circles, just like ours are. In fact, a lot of people think of American folk style as, you know, catch as catch can, wrestling. That's being its like primary originator, but there's actually quite a bit of Cornish wrestling culture that's kind of integrated into American wrestling as well. There's like a bunch of stuff that I found out that I'll save for maybe another episode, but yeah, like Cornish wrestling like made its way over here and definitely affected our American folk style and some of the ways that they did stuff.
Yeah. Part of the reason we even came over and started like getting into Europe is if you look at the history of folk style, it was primarily where folk style comes from was primarily the UK. So I'm sure there are things in Cornish wrestling that are, you know, the style that we call American folk style originated from. And yeah, what's interesting about it is counting the hips too. That, mm-hmm. you know, you could be pinned in American folk style, right? Both shoulders on the mat and still not score you wouldn't end the match in Cornish wrestling, like say if someone had a really good bridge. Yeah, I think the interesting thing is like those faults. So, you know, I watched some of it. I don't know. It's probably today looks fairly different than it did back then. You know, right now, if you're doing it, it's going to look just a lot like judo. It's going to look like a lot like yeah. judo. A lot of hip tosses, a lot of, you know, trips. What's interesting is that in Cornish wrestling, there is no you can't grab the legs.
Right.
But at least from what I could find, it does seem like you could twine the legs, like you could do an outside or an inside trip, but you couldn't grab the legs with your hands.
Yeah, and there's a lot of like grapevining of the legs, right?
Yeah.
Like as someone goes to lift and you kind of hook your leg around their leg to keep them from lifting, there's a lot of that where they hook their legs in together and twine them or kind of like trying to off balance each other, right? Another way I forgot to mention that a win can happen is if there's no score at the end of the match and no one has been able to get a back, then the referees, who are called sticklers, can literally just award the one wrestler the win, which is actually something not entirely foreign to like freestyle wrestling, right?
Yeah.
Like they used to have that. And sticklers, by the way, they're called referees and they're called sticklers because they got these sticks. And there's like some theories about why they have sticks. Some people say it's like It's more ceremonial, if anything, these days, but some people claim, like, oh, they used to be able to use the stick to check to see if there was space between the shoulder and the ground, right, or something like that, or to beat back unruly, spectators. But this is also where the phrase a stickler for the rules comes from. Right. So a stickler for the rules, we think of as a person that is, you know, very focused on getting the rules right and things like that. So they are a stickler. So we've talked a little bit about how it originated. Right. And as it's kind of going through the centuries, there is kind of like this golden era or like kind of heyday of Cornish wrestling. And that's going to be kind of through the 1700s, but especially in the early 1800s, where they were having up to like 50 events a year. And then like, you know, they'd have 150 wrestlers in a bracket at the most, right? These are a lot of like single elimination tournaments or even prize matches, right? Along with, you know, your little local kind of get together wrestling, right? So it was starting to become a little bit more of a thing. It was attracting crowds, crowds as much as 10,000 people. And they would give away prizes to the main wrestlers. Later on, closer to the 1900s, they start giving away like prize money. However, at this time, there was a lot of giving prizes that were either like clothing items or things like cups, right? Like we have something like the Stanley Cup, where it's literally like a big silver dish, right? And you'll see that in a lot of like styles of giving things away, right? For a winner, that things are fashioned in a cup or a dish, right? It's a gold cup or it's a silver cup, right? And that comes from a time and place where you would give a winner something that was a precious metal, right? To something that they could sell easily if they wanted to, or even use. It was like, you know, a way for them to just kind of have a thing to either show off or it has actual value. And then things like they would give them a hat that had, you know, gold trim on it, right?
Yeah, a lot of hats,
but that's not that weird, right? Like you watch the Doc B and all the winners get cowboy hats, right?
Yep.
or the fact that we give out belts that are gilded, right? Like this is all pretty, you know, not that weird sounding. It sounds weird when you read about it because it's like, oh, they got a jacket with silver trim, and it's like, that's cute, you know, but that's not that weird. It's kind of what we still do.
Yeah. And it looked like it was also, you know, there were gradations of it too, right? The gold hat was for the winner. The silver hat was for the guy who came in second. And there are whole tables in this thesis specifically about like what, you know, what prizes were for which people and like half of them were hats.
Well, and at this time, the sport is still kind of like the low man sport, like it's a working class sport. There's a mention of this guy, Thomas Gundry, who was kind of like one of the best ever to do it, right? And he worked as a miner, right? So this is just something he would do on the side. And he took first place in like 24 different competitions over a 15-year period. And it's funny because everyone would talk about like, oh, he was so small because he was 5'8 and 93 kg, which it doesn't sound that small to me.
Oh, it sounds pretty large.
Short king get after it in wrestling. That's how it goes. But then there's also like a lot of accusations of match fixing back then, right? There's a lot of I'm sure it actually happened, like no question. But also like there's like accusations even when it wasn't true, right?
Yeah.
Especially if it was like there wasn't necessarily very strict weight classes. So if you had a huge guy up against like a small guy, and that small guy doesn't look like he's resisting very much, probably out of preservation, people could say like, oh, he's throwing the match.
Yeah. Well, this seemed to also where some of the stickler stuff is also claimed to be from. Part of that claim is also that like the sticks became sticks, and that before that they were swords, and that they had the swords so that if somebody got rowdy in the crowd and was like, oh, like that was bullshit or that call was bad and that's why I just lost money on that, or this match was thrown, that the referee had a sword to protect himself and to calm them down. And that I guess the claim is that later it turned into a stick.
Yeah, probably less blood to clean up when you're just using the sticks. So yeah, there was kind of like this golden era of Cornish wrestling. And you know, that was really cool for the Cornish people. They took a lot of pride in that, right? But there was an eventual decline, and that kind of starts in the late 1800s. And there's a lot of like rise and fall of its popularity. But yeah, late 1800s and into the 1900s, you start to see this kind of slipping of its popularity. And there's, you know, a couple reasons that are given for like for this. A big part of it is it kind of follows the trend of Cornwell's economy, right? When the economy's good, there's a lot more wrestling going on. And when the economy was poor, you have young men like leaving Cornwell, going to find work elsewhere. And, you know, those are the people that are competing in the sport. So you have people like leaving the area. You have this idea, especially of Christian nationalism going on, where the Christians are viewing Cornish wrestling as a kind of as a pagan sport, right? So as Christianity grows in the area, there's a little bit more of like, we should be leaving these old world traditions behind and these pagan traditions behind, right? You know, the match fixing didn't help the sport's popularity. And with the Industrial Revolution, there's a lot less leisure time. And now you have far fewer people in local communities participating because they don't have the time to do so. The sport at this time is still not very well regulated, so it's hard for people to watch and really understand what's going on. And then another big thing is just other sports are popping up and other sports are getting popular. Other sports are being integrated into school systems, right? So you got rugby or football slash soccer, right? Like these are kind of the sports that are getting more popular. And then we come back to the idea of like it's a proletarian sport, right? It's it's out of vogue. It's not gentlemanly. So you definitely see this slipping away. And a lot of I heard a lot of folks, you know, I didn't see a lot of real good articles or, you know, scholarly sources that were going to back this up. But I did like hear some interviews from different folks who are currently involved in Cornish wrestling. And they also felt like the world wars were a big part of it. You know, you had a lot of your young men going off to war, many not coming back. And when they do come back, a lot of them are just like, I don't know, I don't really want to wrestle people anymore. Yeah, and you know, the world's trying to leave old things behind during that time. They're trying to move forward and be progressive and look in a different direction. And tradition just was less of a thing that they really wanted to concern themselves with. So there's just kind of like this big cultural shift and demographic shift going on due to the world wars that a lot of Cornish people feel like affected their wrestling.
Something that was interesting too was this idea of like the Cornish diaspora that you see that basically starting in like 1900s, people were leaving Cornwall in droves, because of the economy. I think partly what's interesting in that idea was that there's like also this claim, and we'll probably get to that when we finally do a judo episode, but there's a claim that the style of judo, that them having the jackets actually originates from Cornish or, you know, some kind of English wrestling, which, you know, I didn't spend too much time checking into, but it does seem interesting, I guess, that at that time, the, you know, the originator of judo was looking at various traditions from around the world, trying to figure out what he wanted to put in. So, but again, I also, it's one of those interesting claims where it's like, oh, you know, our thing is the, we started it.
Yeah. I do want to look a little bit closer at that. Like I saw that as well. And you know, I was like, that's interesting. I'm going to hold off on that. We'll do that.
I think Japan is a little bit closer to Mongolia and they did kind of have a jacket too. So we'll see.
I mean, yeah, exactly. I don't see a reason for me to think like, oh, that just cause a guy visited, like, I don't know. We'll look into it, but but you mentioned the diaspora and there's like apparently Cornish diaspora like much more dispersed than I even realized. Like they're all over the place. And a fun, you know, thing to reveal about that is the largest competition of Cornish wrestling outside of Cornwall was held in Grass Valley, California.
Let's go.
And that was, you know, through that kind of period where there were, you know, the the popularity was about to start dwindling, or was already starting to dwindle, but the diaspora kind of brought it together a little bit, right? And so that was like kind of the late 1800s, early 1900s that this was going on. And there's been other ones. There's been some in Pennsylvania. There was a lot of Cornish people in Wisconsin area, right? So it's kind of cool, like, that this has popped up here and there. But the real consequence of this is Cornish wrestling is definitely diminished into much more of a local cultural celebration, and it's just not quite what it was before.
So there's so many like accounts in newspapers, especially in like the 1800s, you see a ton of enthusiasm for Cornish wrestling. There's so many accounts of huge tournaments. I guess what was also kind of interesting is women just did not watch it, which it probably has more to do with, you know, what they were expected to do, you know, whatever they were doing, you know, was, you know, probably not leisurely. They were probably, you know, sort of forced to be watching children or, you know, doing housework, whatever it was. And then the men are just, you know, they're fucking off. They're having fun watching the wrestling. But there's so many accounts of like these huge crowds for these wrestling matches, everyone taking trains to them. There's one really funny story that, you know, maybe apocryphal or maybe not, but that was a woman came to a Cornish wrestling tournament and it was her wedding day, and she found her groom at the tournament and he was just watching the wrestling. And she tried to get him to come to the wedding, and he tried to run across the ring, and everybody closed ranks and they wouldn't let him. And she chased him around for a while until she grabbed him, and then he had to go, you know, do the wedding, which is,
that's funny.
It's a very, very funny story. Just like, no, I have to watch the, be like me at NCAA is just like, no, it's the finals. The finals happening. I have to watch Keegan O'Toole.
Yeah, nowadays I think people are just better at scheduling.
Yeah, you'd think you'd be able to, well, I guess, you know, probably back then it was a little bit different. You schedule your wedding, you know, months in advance. All of a sudden, you know, a tournament pops up. You don't know there's going to be a tournament. You know, you don't.
Or maybe
the
tournament just lasted a few days longer than, you know, you thought it would, you know.
You're not scheduling it on Google Calendar. You don't know what's going on.
All right. I think we've covered about everything that I picked up through here. I know that they're, you know, obviously it continues to be a celebration of heritage. They were actually finally recognized, like the governing body was finally recognized by the British Association. But that took until like the early 2000s for them to do that. And, you know, kind of a call to action here for any Cornwall listeners or Cornish listeners. You know, it's kind of there's a lack of funding. Like, apparently they couldn't put on a tournament or like a little local tournament because they couldn't raise like $500, like, like a few years ago.
Not
so,
a lot of money.
Hey, if you're Cornish, if you want to like keep some of your local tradition going on, some local indigenous activity happening, you know, chip in, find your local Cornish Wrestling Association and help them out.
I mean, it is really interesting too. How much of at least like some of the European stuff, I don't know, so much of like we go over some of these old styles and some of them appear to be so popular, and then they just like something happens where it's, I mean, it looks like it, for this it was really like the 1900s, like 1920 it was so popular until then, and then it's like 1920 and obviously there's like World War One, there's like Cornish diaspora, there's all these economic problems, and then it just falls off a map and it's never seen again. It's just not popular anymore. It's just kind of interesting how that can happen. I mean, it goes from being, you know, clearly the most popular sporting event that they have to just nothing. Nobody cares anymore. But it's also interesting to contrast that with like Mongolia, where we looked at it and it was always the most popular sport. You know, like 1,000, 2,000 probably, or even more than that years ago. And then it's still the most popular sport.
I mean, we really shouldn't be that surprised to learn that Mongolian people have better taste than British people, though.
just took a shit right next to where I record.